I think what has given me the most freedom in my life is to understand that I am who I am, and it is God who made me this way.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, you know, I would like to think that as a believer, that I'm going to have this completely different life, that everything's going to work out well, that I'm going to get what I want, that I'm not going to sin anymore, that things are going to look really great in my life. But the longer that I'm a Christian, I find that that's really, really not how it is. That I get, in fact, to see more and more of the sin in my life. And alongside that, as a believer, want more and more to be holy, to be set aside, to be sanctified by the Spirit of God.
We've been talking about what are the different characteristics of sanctification. That is, what are the things that begin to emerge in our life when God comes along and kind of magically transforms us into different people.
And that's what I'm saying, Jack. I want him to magically transform me into a person that's just really beautiful and
right.
Never sins.
Right. That ain't going to happen. That's not promised in the Scriptures. But one of the remarkable things that does happen is that we have the eyes to see how far short of that kind of perfection we fall. We're kind of clueless before God goes to work on us, before we gain this wisdom that God wants to give us. We really don't have a clue how bad off we are morally. And through the process of the Spirit of God teaching us and tutoring us and training us in this wisdom, we begin to see what we are now in comparison to what God will give us when he gives us our inheritance in the next age, the kind of perfection and glory that will be. That's not the only thing that we learn about ourselves, but that's a big one.
Well, that's what we'd like to talk about more today is, what does sanctification look like in our lives? And one of the things that it looks like is that I have a growing understanding of myself that's really different than I had before I was a believer.
Right. There are probably more things that could be said, but the thing that comes to mind are about four different things that we learn about ourselves. We learn that we are finite and limited, and we learn to accept that and live with that. We learn that we're not the center of God's universe, something that does not come naturally to us. We learn that we are a creation, and in fact a remarkable creation of God. And then we also learn that although we are remarkable creations of God, we are morally unworthy.
Well, let's start with, I am finite and limited.
Okay.
What does that mean? I mean, it's not good news. I don't like to think I'm finite and limited, nor do I like to think I'm not the center of the world, but let's go with it.
Okay. Let me not answer your question directly, but kind of indirectly. In recent years, I've been very interested in a Greek term that gets used in the New Testament. It's the word sophrosune. I first became intrigued when I was reading one of the Platonic dialogues where
I've been around you long enough to know what Platonic dialogue means, but it's some of the writings of Plato.
Yeah, of the ancient Greek philosopher Plato. And in that, often in his dialogues, the protagonist is a philosopher called Socrates, that most people are familiar with his name. Socrates is discussing with some other people the meaning of the term sophrosune. Well, sophrosune occurs a handful of times in the New Testament. And I think it's a pretty important word. As best I can understand it.
Now, wait a minute. Sophrosune doesn't appear in the English. So what's the English translation of sophrosune?
Well, interestingly, at least the New American Standard Version that I often use typically translates it as self-control.
Hmm.
But I don't, that really doesn't do it, I think. It doesn't really capture what the term means. The term has to do with the notion in the ancient world that the gods, that is, if you were thinking in terms of the polytheism out of which the meaning of the term arose, the gods who are driving history have placed certain boundaries on your life. They want you to go here and no further, or they want you to succeed to this level and no further, and they want you to have this level of abilities but not beyond that, that kind of thing. And the virtue of the ancient pagans was that we need to learn to live within the boundaries that have been set for us by the gods and by fate. Well, when you bring that into the Christian context, of course, it's not the gods and it's not fate that we're talking about. But I think the apostles recognize that there's a very important parallel between the living God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the true God that exists, and the boundaries placed by the gods and fate within paganism, in that God does the same thing. God creates me to be me. He creates me to have these talents, these abilities, these gifts, these circumstances. I'm in this socioeconomic class, not another. I'm in this society and culture, not another. I have this set of parents and this family, not another one. I'm dealt the cards that I'm dealt by the living God himself. He has designed me, he has conceived me, he has created me to be exactly this person at this time in history. Well, but the problem is, to have defined me so carefully and so in such detail puts all kinds of limitations on me, because if I am this person, then I'm not anybody else. And I don't have their circumstances, and I don't have their opportunities, and I don't have their abilities, and right on down the list. And so they recognize that the pagans were right about something, that a godly and a righteous person is going to respond to the limitations and the definition of who they are by simply saying, God, you are my creator. You have every right to make me the person you have made me to be. I will accept that. I will bow to that. I will submit to that rather than fight against it.
So using the language of today, it's kind of like saying owning who I am.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think you'd even go further than that, though, is maybe God would want us to embrace who we are.
Right, right.
That he has given us.
Right.
That's a really hard thing to do.
Oh, it's very hard to do. I just remember when I was younger and going through, in the 60s, we had identity crises. I don't know if they do that anymore, but as young people, we had identity. We went through our identity crisis. And that precisely what we were calling an identity crisis was exactly that confrontation with myself that has to happen as I enter into adulthood. I come to the realization that I have limitations, that I am who I am, and then I face the very important personal and existential question, am I going to accept who I am, or am I going to throw some kind of temper tantrum where I bang against the concrete barriers of my life trying to break out, trying to be someone I'm not, trying to be somebody else, or just try to break free of these boundaries that the Creator has put on me.
I was talking to a young high school girl just last week, and she was telling me that she was so upset because she really wasn't as bright as the other people that she hung out with, other people in her school, and was really having a difficult time seeing herself as having any value. Just basically thought she was pretty stupid and couldn't do anything well and hadn't really achieved anything and didn't have any characteristics that were especially helpful in her life. And she is really, really discouraged. That's something that happens to a lot of us throughout our lives, is
right.
There are limitations that we have. And I don't know with this girl if she really has intellectual limitations. She certainly doesn't sound stupid. But maybe she doesn't have as high an IQ as many of the people that she hangs out with. And that is one of the limitations that you're talking about that God has given her, and
right.
That she's going to have to work within those boundaries.
Yeah, and often I think we find that what look like limitations are actually only limitations in the context of our culture. That is, our culture has tended to exalt certain kind of intelligence. another kind of intelligence may be just as marvelous, really, objectively, just as phenomenal, but we, since it's not valued in quite the same way by our culture, it looks like a deficit. It looks like it's really a disadvantage.
Well, I know from my own self, Jack, that was so true, because I really struggled in my life trying to do well in school, and I ended up doing really well when I got actually into graduate school. But prior to that time, it just didn't click in. I really did feel dumb. I could really understand what this girl was talking about. And I think what was going on is I had different skills and talents. I thought differently than a lot of people did, and I just hadn't come into my own yet in terms of understanding that. And I thought very differently than my parents, especially in particular my father, who was an engineer and very, very different way of thinking than I have. And I thought that I should be like him, and he thought that I should think more like him. And that's very understandable. But I couldn't, he really wanted me to be a business major, and I tried to take economics. And, you know, I went to my son's parent-teacher conference this last week, and I sat down with the economics teacher, and the first thing I did is I sat down and I said, well, I just want to let you know that the only class I really cheated in college was economics. I hate economics. But I just took economics because that's what my dad wanted me to do, and because I thought I should be able to think that way. I took physics, and I mean, things that just weren't at all things that my brain could click into, and it took me many years to finally figure out, oh, I can think well. I just can think this way and not that way. And if I try to push myself into that category, it just ain't going to work.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Yeah, you just are who you are, who God created you to be. You're not somebody else.
That's right. You're not
your father. You're not your teacher.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the crucial thing to come to terms with. And along with that, the piece that has to go with that is, God wouldn't have made me to be the person that he made me to be if it wasn't okay with him. Hmm. I mean, that there really is a virtue in me being the person I am with the strengths that I have and the abilities that I have, that there really is a virtue in that. It's not a deficit. It's just a different way to be a human being, a different way to think, a different way to see, and
lots of times it's our challenge to figure out what that way is.
Right.
And that's quite a challenge, because on one hand, when you're saying we're finite, we have limitations, that's really true. And some people, actually, they're born with no legs, and that's an incredible, obvious limitation. But for other of us, the limitations can be and should be faced into. You're not saying, okay, well, Christine, you felt like you were dumb in high school, so you just got to embrace that you're dumb. That's not, I hope, what you're saying.
No. I mean, it depends on how we define that. If we phrase it a little bit differently, I'm not as capable of doing this sort of analysis or this sort of calculation as somebody else. So just accept the fact that you're not as good as some other people at doing that kind of analysis and that kind of calculation. I am saying that. Mm-hmm. But see, the kind of damning category dumb is just not very useful. And that's what we have to learn, is that my strengths intellectually are elsewhere. They're someplace else. Even if nobody else in the world admires them, even if nobody else in the world really acknowledges them, I can be okay. I should be able to get to a position where I'm okay with that, because my Creator acknowledges them. And he doesn't consider it dumb, in other words. Mm-hmm.
And yet I might really have to search, like I did, to figure out where I fit into this world. And I fit into this world very differently than anyone else in my whole family. There were six of us, including my parents. I'm not like anybody else there. I'm kind of a weirdo in my family. Mm-hmm. And yet I have found a niche that really does work for me. And that's what I've had to come and just say, you know, my sister's great with numbers. My brother's great with numbers. You know, everybody in my family can do really well with that, and I simply cannot. Don't ask me to remember an address or a telephone number, and for heaven's sakes, if you want me to keep books, what are you talking about? So I just don't do those things well.
Right.
But I've had to really search it out and look for what I did well, and I think we should give that message, that we're not just saying, when you see that you have a limitation, sit back and say, I'm a failure. I can't go anywhere. But I can work with this. And some way it is valuable. God gave it to me, so it is. It's different than other people. I might indeed have a lower IQ or be shorter so I can't shoot basketballs or be too tall so I can't fit into the clothes that are available in the stores. But nonetheless, that's who God made me to be.
Right.
And I need to work with it. Buy right. bigger clothes and decide not to play basketball, but go swimming instead.
And there is a response that comes very natural to us that really is a kind of temper tantrum. I mean, we are just utterly ungrateful. I mean, our attitude toward God is, God, you have cursed me by making me the one that you've made me to be.
Yes.
This is a curse. My life is a prison, and I hate it, and I want out, and you are a bad God for having done this to me. That's a very, very natural response. But yet that's the evil and the rebellious sinner in me responding. The righteous response, and the way I'm going to begin to respond as I become mature in my sanctification, is a kind of self-acceptance, a kind of self-appreciation, a kind of self-acknowledgement that God did make me a remarkable creature as well. I'm different than the other people around me, but I'm a remarkable creature, and it's okay that he made me this one and not some other one. That's an incredibly difficult moral, spiritual state to get to, but I think that's where we're headed in our sanctification.
I think that probably, Jack, you're saying that maybe many of us have temper tantrums, not liking who we are. I would guess that most of us have those kind of temper tantrums.
Well, I expect all of us at one time or another, and to some degree or another, I expect all of us.
So what did you not like about yourself?
Well, I thought I was... Well, the critical event in my whole life, probably the most critical event, was when I failed a physics exam in my sophomore year in college. I had come out of high school. I had a really, really good physics teacher, and I had kind of fallen in love with the subject. So when I went away to school, I aimed at...
You fell in love with physics?
Yeah.
I don't like you anymore.
when I went away to college, I aimed at majoring in physics, and I just figured that that's what I would do. So I did. I started down a physics track. I got in my sophomore year, I got into kind of intermediate level classes, and I was in the middle of a class on what's called mechanics in physics. At the same time, I was sort of active in my Christian group on campus. And one night, a guy in my dorm who knew that I was a outspoken Christian came down and said, I want to talk to you about Christianity. Well, that was the night before a midterm in my physics class, and I should have been studying. But in the mindset that I was in at that point in time, I thought, and I would probably do the same thing today, I thought, I can't say no to someone who wants to talk about the faith. That's much more important than my midterm. So I went up to his room, and we talked into the wee hours of the morning. And then when I was done, I came back down, and I faced a choice. I can either now study for my midterm, or I can go to bed. I decided I was pretty tired. I was going to go to bed. Maybe I'd study a little bit in the morning and kind of said a little prayer. God, I scratched back your back. Will you scratch mine? That I think that was my mentality, even though I don't remember how I phrased the prayer. When I got up the next morning, I just studied for a half hour or so. I just got really anxious because I had never in my life gone into a test so unprepared, so having not freshened up my memory of what the material was. And I'm sure, naturalistically speaking, that's what contributed to what followed. I went into the exam and got the test in front of me. I got half of one formula in the blue book, and then my mind just, I panicked, and my mind went absolutely blank. And
nothing
I could
there.
Not retrieve it. I couldn't get anything. I mean, it was a blank slate. I sat there for a whole hour and wrote nothing down on the exam. Well, needless to say, the professor didn't think that was a very great performance. And I knew that I flunked the exam when I walked out of there. And the next week, the next week was a real spiritual crisis for me, because I had lived for my grade point average. I had never really thought of myself as particularly intelligent, because I was not a particularly precocious. I was not intellectually precocious. I was always surrounded by people that were always a lot quicker and a lot brighter and a lot more capable, articulate and capable than I was. But I worked hard, and I had made my grade point average basically the reason that it was important that I existed. That was the meaning of my existence, was that number that was my grade point average.
That was it.
That was it. So God comes along and pulls the plug on that, or at least what he, basically what I heard God saying in that event is, Jack, this grade point average that you have managed to maintain is really pretty vulnerable. I mean, like, I could obliterate that really fast. You know, this little blank in your mind trick isn't one I can do again and again and again. So what do you think about that? Are you going to follow me or not? And it took me a week to answer that question. I mean, I teetered on the brink of cursing God and losing my grade point average, flunking out of school, and, you know, whatever else I imagined.
So in other words, it was, God, I scratched your back, and you did not scratch mine. You didn't keep the deal for me.
Right. Actually, I don't know how much that played into my crisis, however. That was a part of my mentality. I mean, he had definitely let me down by not supernaturally saving me. But it was more, what the focal point of my crisis was more, look what God is capable of doing. He doesn't have to preserve your grade point average. He doesn't have to give you this idol that has been the God that has given meaning to your life. He can smash that idol in a second, Jack. So what are you going to do about that? Do you want your idol to be the basis of your existence, or do you want God to be the basis of your existence? And that ought to have been an easy question to answer, but it was not. It took me a whole week, and I've told people before that I must have been a really strange sight during that week. I was so internal during that week, so absorbed with myself inside, with this struggle inside, that I don't remember, I don't know how I got through the week. I don't know how I functioned, because I was so obsessed with this question. But I just remember on the Friday of that week, walking into my dorm room, flopping down on my bed, and just beginning to weep really, really deeply. And about 45 minutes later, I got up off the bed, and somehow had decided, I mean, the word that comes to mind is the phrase that Job uses, though he slay me, yet will I follow him. Though he flunk me out of school, yet will I follow him. Somehow, and I don't even know how, I mean, it wasn't like I gave myself an argument or gave myself evidence or gave myself any reasons. I just got up off that bed determined that God was so important that it really didn't make, nothing else really mattered. I didn't know what it meant anymore because I was so confused, but what I needed to do was serve Him and make that the kind of
focal point
of my life, of
rather
my existence.
Rather than the number, grade right. point average.
Right. So my identity crisis was my, I look back and I think I wonder if that wasn't in fact my conversion experience. You know, I had been a Christian activist before that, but I don't know that I really knew what it meant to be a Christian until that day. So it may have been my actual rebirth.
Hmm.
Probably not. No. The evidence before that was, I mean, it was probably just a very important quantum leap in my maturity.
Certainly, but in your mind it was a sealer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In that's true. There was no going back after that day. I mean, that was the moment. I think it's kind of like Abraham's being asked to offer Isaac on the altar. If you remember that account, after Abraham has been willing to do that, and God says, "Well, never mind. Here's a ram." The voice, the divine voice out of heaven, says, "Because you have done this thing, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply you," and all that. And he repeats all the promises that he's made to Abraham over the course of a number of years, and says, "I swear that this is going to happen." And the author of Hebrews in the New Testament makes a big deal out of that. He says, "He with two unchangeable things, he confirmed these promises with his word and with his oath. God confirmed that he was going to keep these promises." You know, what's the significance of that? I think I can feel the significance of that because I look back at that event in my life in the same way as Abraham, that there was a sense in which there was no turning back after that. I had made a kind of irrevocable, irreversible decision about what I wanted my life to be all about.
You know, I think using biblical language, see if this fits, you had, in a very practical way, died to yourself.
Exactly, exactly.
You had gone to the cross, and you were going to now no longer live for the grade point average, but had a whole different perspective. You died to what you had wanted before, and now you wanted something new.
Right, yeah, and I think you're right. I think that that's exactly what that metaphor means, dying to yourself. Taking your agenda and your ambitions and your dreams and your hopes in this world and saying, I'm willing to let them all be cast aside just to follow you.
You know, as a counselor, I work with a lot of married people, people who are very disappointed in their marriages, many, many people who are disappointed. And this is another area where I think we find ourselves quite finite, quite limited, not only in terms of our own personal characteristics, but in terms of our personal choices and the situation that we find ourselves in, like the situation in marriage. Many people struggle really desperately up against the choice that they made in their marriage partner. And it's so crucial for people to think through, in terms of what we're talking about here, is this what God gave me, and is this what I'm going to embrace, I'm going to own, and I'm going to work with? I always feel like when I'm working with these people that, or not just feel like, but I am, teetering on the edge a lot of them making a decision to go and leave their spouse, either emotionally or physically, you know, or if they're going to stay and just be on the fence, or if they're going to stay and really say, this is what God gave me, and this is what I'm going to work with, and I'm going to make it better. Just last week, I was working with somebody who has a very, very difficult marriage, not an abusive one, but a very unsatisfying one, one that they know will never, probably, you know, 90% chance, never be satisfying to them. And yet, they came in last week, and it just, wow, makes me cry. I hear them say, you know, I know that my spouse is going to be this way, and I see this, and this, and this, and this. And they're very realistic. And God gave me this person, and I'm going to work to grow and learn and develop in the context of this marriage that God gave me. And you know what I think will happen with that person? I don't know about their marriage, but that person's blossoming already. Mm-hmm. Already I see less of a tantrum, less of a hard-heartedness, more of a softness that wants to go toward embracing what God has given them.
Right.
And it's not easy. They're not saying, no big deal. And I think that's a big part of it. Lots of times we can do fine because we just ignore the fact that it's a problem. But it seems to me that the spiritual person looks directly at what the issue is, and they're willing to embrace it with its difficulty.
Mm-hmm. That trait that allows us to make that kind of decision that you just described, I think that's what the New Testament means by sophrosune. That just facing into the reality of the situation that God has actually given me in all of its disappointment, and yet saying, but God created me to be this person in these set of circumstances. I accept that, and I'm going to learn to know Him and grow in this context. The incredible ability to do that is a supernatural virtue of sophrosune.
Okay, so let me muddy the waters up a bit. This could sound really simple, but the reality of our lives are sometimes we don't know if the situation we're in is the situation we should be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People in marriages where they are in a situation where they could be abused, or their children could be abused, or are being, you know, where do you draw the line? What kind of decisions do you make? Do you separate for a while? Do you stay in it? Do you just draw the line and make a divorce? Lots and lots of times, it is not a simple situation. People who are in a perhaps they're very poor, it's maybe not straightforward to them. Should I take 5 years off and go back to school and go to college and put my family through that? Or should I just embrace the fact that we're just going to live on very little money and just embrace that as what God wants in our lives? So those kind of situations, I'm sure you can imagine more, come up all the time, and it's not easy to know what should I do about this?
Right. No. And the fact that sofrasuni is a virtue doesn't solve any of those problems, because sofrasuni is just an attitude of the heart and a disposition toward God. Am I willing to let Him be my Creator? Am I willing to let Him be the one who defines my life? Or do I not want that? Do I not want Him to define my life? Do I want to take my life in my hands and create it the way I want it to be? That disposition.
And that's like a disposition. You're saying people can't see your hand. It's kind of clenched.
I'm clenching my fist.
It's a demand on God. I will not have it this way, and I'm going to have it different, and I don't care what it takes. It's an unwillingness under any circumstances to accept what I've been given.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's very different than the attitude of saying, okay, I'm not making, for example, very much money here. I think what I'm going to do is try, go back to school, get different training or whatever, and go in that direction. But it isn't a clenched fist, and God, you better give that to me.
Right.
It's more an open-handedness of, I'm going to try in this direction, I'm going to try my hardest.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not work. And if it does not work, then is God my God? Like with your situation, you had your fist clenched, so to speak, with your grade point average, and God pried your hand open and made it a whole different perspective.
Right. Yeah, that's well said.
And where I think you kept probably studying very hard and you've continued studying throughout your life,
mm-hmm.
but the attitude is different, and that's what we're trying to communicate.
Yeah, exactly. If we follow a certain track in my life, we're just using my common sense, my reason, my wisdom, trying to be godly, trying to do the right thing, and yet trying to change my circumstances. There's nothing wrong with trying to change your circumstances per se. But what happens when God says, no, I'm not going to let you go there. I'm not going to let you be wealthy or even comfortable. You're going to live in poverty your whole life. And so everywhere I turn, it always ends up being a roadblock, an obstacle, a failure. Now what do I do? Well, if I have sofrasune, then I can ultimately say, well, so be it. It's not out of laziness that I don't have it. It's not out of lack of prudence on my part. God has just ordained that this is not going to work for me. This is not going to happen. Am I willing to accept that? The sanctified person says, well, yes, why not? I mean, how could I do otherwise? The God who defines my life is defining it this way. The one who is not being sanctified ultimately comes to the point where they clench their fists and say, damn you, God, you are a curse. You are a bad God, and I don't like you.
I don't want you, I won't have you, and get away from me.
Right. Right.
And it isn't when someone says that once, because part of our temper tantrum could be,
sure.
Oh, I don't like this.
Yeah, that's a good point. All of us have said, damn you, God, at one point or another in our lives. But
maybe not using quite that word, or maybe using
Yeah,
that
maybe
word.
Or maybe not. But when we settle down and get some perspective on our life, we don't really mean that, and we go the other direction.
So I was just thinking of something with sofrasuni, it goes in two directions. We might not have something and never get it and need to still accept that from the hand of God, even with our best efforts. Or we might have something like you had the grade point average and lose it,
mm-hmm.
and need to accept that.
And then a third category is we might have something that we don't see as desirable that's undesirable that will never go away, too.
Yes.
That's another one.
Yes. Okay, I think we've kind of covered this. Unless you have something more to say, what we were talking about is that part of being a believer is that God is changing us in the direction of having a new and different understanding of ourselves. Part of it is this whole area of being finite or being limited. Okay, the second area that we were talking about, God has given us growing understanding that I am not the center of the universe. And man, I want to kick my feet and throw myself on the floor. I mean, not really, but it's really, well, I don't know, Jack. I can see myself sometimes in my discussions with my husband kind of having this tantrum. It doesn't exactly look like throwing myself on the floor and kicking, but maybe my husband experiences it that way, that I really want something. It's really tough for me to give it up, for me to think somebody else should get what they want when I really, really want it that way.
We just come in with this inborn tendency to think that because I'm me, I should get what I want, and other people's lives should kind of adjust themselves around my desires and needs and expectations. And
yeah,
it never...
or even more subtle, it's I don't see anybody else. Mine's the standard.
Yeah, yeah.
It's this way because it should be this way because this is the right way.
Right.
And I may not be as arrogant to say that. I mean, I would know not to say that, but I think it's really easy not to have the perspective that other people may have something on the ball also.
Something on the ball.
They might have I'm not the only standard. They might have some good thoughts or ideas about how a decision should be made or what they should value. And I'm not the standard. And I think that's what we're really talking about here is seeing God as the standard rather than myself as the standard.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because the true center of the universe is, of course, God and His will, His program, His plan. The center of created reality is His Son, Jesus. If there's anyone who really is in a position to rightfully say, it's going to be this way because I want it this way, it's God. That's why our selfishness is very God-like. That what I mean by that is we are acting like we're little gods.
It's not God-like as in
good. No, not as in good. It's God-like as in
playing God.
In the day that you eat of it, you will become like God, knowing good and evil. It's the consequence of our sin and rebellion. It's the warped perspective that we as sinners have, the perspective that, well, I am God after all. Mm-hmm. And you're right, we would never say it in that way. We would never explicitly put it that way or think of it that way, but our actions betray that that's our real attitude all the time.
Yeah, well, I think some of us would say, I mean, really do diligently believe that we know better than other people and we have the right to put that belief on others. There's been tyrants throughout the history of the world who would say, I just do know. Like, I don't know if this fits here, but like Hitler would say, of course the Aryan race is better. That's just the way it is. We're better, we have the standard, and we have the right to kill all the people who are not like us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in essence, though, in our relationships, lots of us work that way. That we are destroying other people by our demand to have it our way. This is not a little thing. This is not doesn't have small consequences in the lives of people around us. It has enormous consequences.
Right. A colleague of mine at the study center, Ron Julian, has helped me see how fundamental this is in our life. One of the things that he points out is how it leads to this perpetual double standard in our lives. That if I'm being, you know, basically a kind of obnoxious person, my expectation is that you'll give me room to be imperfect. That is, you'll be merciful toward me. You'll give me some space and give me some slack. If you're being obnoxious, I want you to stop and stop now. There's the double standard. I want you to show me mercy. I want judgment to come to bear on you for exactly the same thing. That's this fundamental self-centeredness that we have. I am the most important person in this equation. Therefore, whatever is of any advantage to me, that should be the way the world works. And it doesn't really make any difference whether you're at a disadvantage or not. The question is it of advantage to me that the world work this way? So it's an advantage to me for you to be merciful to me. It's an advantage to me for me to be kind of demanding and judgmental and make you stop behaving in the way that you're behaving. That's arising out of this self-centeredness, this fundamental essential thinking that I am God that motivates my actions and attitudes. And as you say, I mean, that attitude day in and day out in our lives is just devastating in relationships. It just wreaks all kinds of havoc in our lives.
Yeah, it does. It's easy for me to see me. It's really not easy for me to see you. And I mean, this is in addition to what you just said. I mean, I really like what you just shared. You know, I want to do what is to my advantage. But I'm coming back also to, I really see myself. And it's hard for me to see that other people have as much to say as I do. because I get it. It makes sense to me. It's easy to fall into that trap. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a sort of a different point, but it's a related point. Yeah.
Right.
That your values and your perceptions are kind of the standard for how the world should be viewed and how it should be seen. And
yeah, because I just get it. Because I just, right. How my mind has worked. Because it's just makes sense that way. And when you go a different direction, it just kind of doesn't make sense that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to stop and think, okay, maybe they have as good an idea as I do about this particular thing. I was watching my daughter with her friend the other day, and it's a very simple thing, but her daughter had this big, huge CD player that her friend wanted to put in the back of the car. And my daughter was pushing the back end down on top of her, saying, no, no, you need to put that in the back seat. You don't put it here. And the other little girl was saying, well, I think that it will work really well here. She's trying to lift it up. But I think that's just a really simple description of what we do all the time. My daughter really thought it was better there. The little girl thought it was better there. And they just couldn't, you know, compromise with each other. And that doesn't have big consequences. But the reality is, that's what goes on in a less explicit and obvious way in our relationships all the time. And that's another reason why it's so devastating. And that's the power struggle that we're in. You change so that I'll be comfortable. And the other person says, no, you change so I'll be comfortable.
Yes, exactly.
And what we're trying to go for again is our comfort and not looking at, this person is just different, just doing it in a different way than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it does come down to our selfishness, comes down to our pride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's what we're saying is, that's part, a fundamental part of what begins to change as we become sanctified, is that we begin to see, we begin to have the wisdom, we begin to understand that there are other fellow creatures out there that are my equals, my peers.
Mm-hmm.
God did not create me and a bunch of servants for me. He created me and the rest of the human creation, all of us, to be His servants, to have our lives revolve around Him and our relationship to Him. And to make that adjustment and realize that they have equal rights to the things that I want. They have equal dignity, equally valid perspective, equally valid value system, and so on, equally valid perceptions to mine. For me to come to see that is a huge aspect of my maturity.
And Jack, my maturity doesn't just come in seeing that. It's easy theoretically to see that.
Yeah, right.
I can imagine that there's a lot of people saying, wait up.
Yeah.
You guys,
yeah.
This is not new information. but to really live with it, in
yeah.
relationships that are close to us, like with our spouses and with our children, and in perhaps a business meeting. I mean, I can think even here sometimes, you know, I want it to go a particular way, and it's hard for me just to swallow it sometimes and just think, you know, Jack's Jack. Jack isn't going to do it Christine's way. And I just need to kind of settle down and let you have it your way sometimes. And think, well, okay, I need just to live with, I'm not the sinner here.
Mm-hmm.
But on a theoretical level, that's real easy to think
right.
of that.
Right.
On a practical level, when the rubber meets the road, when it may cost me some time, it may cost me some money, it may cost me some discomfort in some way, I might not look as good if we do it a particular way, et cetera, et cetera. In a sense, it's kind of little deaths to myself all the time. To keep on determining not to be the center of the universe.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Actually, the point you're making is a point that it's worth making. Generally speaking, when we're talking about wisdom, we're not talking about just theory. We're not just talking about an intellectual, a way to put the world together intellectually and see reality intellectually that is coherent and rational. It's really hard to define this, but it's much more, it's deeper, it's more personal. The term I would like as a philosopher is it's existential. That is, we not only see that the world is that way, but that we so thoroughly embrace viewing the world that way that it affects everything we do, everything we see, everything we value, and everything that we are. And that's what you're saying, is that, yeah, it's no big deal for us to, especially as Americans, with our cultural value of equality, it's no big deal for us to theoretically embrace the idea that we are all equal. But can I live my life really in the light of that being really fundamentally true? We don't. Not without God instilling a whole lot deeper wisdom in us than we come packaged with.
Lots of times my husband marries people. He does the wedding ceremony. One of the things that he says over and over again is, so-and-so, wife, you're different than your husband, and husband, you're different than your wife. And he goes on and kind of explains that a little bit. And every time he says that, that is so moving to me, because I have experienced myself as so different than my husband. I would have said in the beginning, before we got married, yeah, obviously, Larry and I are really different. But being married to him, it's just so incredibly, profoundly true. And it really makes such a huge difference. But I think people could really pass over what he's saying as though that's not a profound thing for him to be saying. But if we can really grasp that, you're different than the other guy. And in your differences, you need to understand that you need to open up your blinders and look at who the other person is and be willing to, on a very practical level, live with their differences, go with their differences, embrace their differences, and love them in the context of their differences, not just try to change them or say, I can't change it, boy, are they a creep. Mm-hmm. It's a huge thing to do in our life.
Yeah, because what's natural is for us to insist that they be like me and that they be my clone.
Okay, we need to go back. This is the end of the hour. And look at what we've said today about what it looks like to be a believer. What we're talking about today is being a believer means that we're going to have a growing understanding of ourselves in a different way than non-believers have.
Yeah, this is not just kind of emotional and psychological maturity. We're talking about something far more remarkable than that, a spiritual maturity that transforms the very way that we look at and live our lives and the perceptions we have of reality and the attitudes we take into it. And the two things we were talking about today...
But wait a minute. It's a spiritual look, but isn't our emotional and mental...
Are they affected? Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. They are a part of who I am and my spiritual perspective.
Yeah. The point I was making is that there are a lot of people who are non-believers who grow up. They become adults.
I see.
And so they learn how to live more smoothly with other people and what works and what doesn't work. And they're civilized and decent and gregarious and warm and so on. But that's not spiritual maturity. The spiritual maturity that the Bible is talking about is taking me and making me into what the Bible calls a new creature. I look at life so profoundly differently than I would as a non-believer that it's not just a matter of becoming a grown-up.
New actions.
It's a matter of becoming a new creature.
It's not new actions, it's new heart.
Exactly, yeah. At the core of my being, I'm different.
Okay, so the two areas that we looked at today.
We looked at the word sophrosune, which is the virtue of coming to embrace the fact that I am an individual created by God with limitations put on me. I'm finite. I can't be and am not whatever I want to be. I am only that which God created me and exactly which God created me. And then we also looked at the fact that I'm not the center of the universe. God is that. I'm not. And I need to learn to accept that.
Have you ever wondered what the first Christmas was like for Mary? The angel Gabriel appears to her and announces that she is to have a son who will be the long-awaited Messiah. With the special Son of God as her offspring, Mary probably thought that her life would be a success. It would be altogether joyous, peaceful, and glorious. But it didn't turn out that way. In his News and Views article, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Jack Crabtree illustrates how the first Christmas story went against Mary's and our expectations. It was chaotic, messy, and sad. Jack writes that the rebirth of our spirits will proceed along the same lines as the Christmas story began. It's going to be messy, shooting all our expectations to pieces. our lives will be a growing awareness that the path to hope and victory will be painful, disappointing, chaotic, and marred by evil. But true believers will, just like Mary, treasure the promises of God so deeply and securely in their hearts that no amount of messiness or evil will extinguish them. Call McKinsey Study Center for your free copy of the article, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Our radio program has a real need for financial support. We've had a huge opportunity to begin this program and actually continue it for a year and a half, with the very generous grant of a couple of people. But now that money is running out and we need to ask for support. Jack, a really difficult thing in my life when I think about where I give money is, how do I decide to give money to who? You know, what do I give to? Because there's so many needs. I know in the paper that McKinsey Study Center put out recently said that there were huge needs for McKinsey Study Center. Just the physical facility needs a new roof. I know it needs a lot of internal work. They have a plea for money there. There are people who have just gone through that horrendous flood, and they're starving, literally starving.
In Honduras.
In Honduras, yeah. Our pastors at church need support. Missionaries, I have friends that have needs. How do we go about deciding where we give our limited resources?
Well, two comments. I think first we need to recognize that anything that is consistent with God's values, to do what's good, to do what's right, to do what's compassionate, to do what's loving, is to give our money to God, is to worship God with our money. I think oftentimes we kind of get a more narrow mindset that it's only the money that I give to the church that I'm giving to God. And if I give money to the victims of the flood in Honduras, that somehow doesn't really count. Well, that's a wrong way to think about it, because God, who is the owner of all my money, is simply asking me to manage the resources that he's entrusted to me in keeping with his values. And to show compassion with money is certainly in keeping with God's values. So that's a perfectly valid and legitimate and godly thing to do with my resources. Beyond that, I think there's just a lot of freedom. What do I want to do? What interests me? What is attractive to me? As long as the reason it's attractive is that it's attractive for godly reasons, that is, out of godly values, because it's good, because it's righteous, because it's compassionate, because it's loving, because it's just. If it's attractive to me for those reasons, then I think there's really no right or wrong about where I give it. It's just a matter of personal freedom from there, I think, and personal desire.
So what we would like to put out there to people is, if you feel like this is a good place for your money to go, for continuing our program here at Christianity at Work, we'd really encourage you to do so. We really value this program. We'd like to see it continue. If God wants it to continue, people are going to give support. If he doesn't, they won't.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKinsey staff has worked for years studying the Bible. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKinsey staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.